Well, over 100 years ago, March 25th, 1911, there was a fire in New York City at the Triangle Shirt Factory, which is basically what we would refer to today as a sweatshop. There was nearly 500 people inside, many of them trapped at the 8th and 9th floors. New York Fire Department at that time was simply overwhelmed by the logistics of the problem and offered very little help. Those who were trapped were mostly girls and young women who were working in the place at that time. Many of them jumped to their deaths, fell to their deaths, or were crushed to death in the stairwells. 146 people died in that inferno. And the primary reason for the high death toll was because the exit doors were locked. The owners of the company thought that they needed to prevent any theft of clothing or material from the facility there. And so as part of the daily routine, they would, once the shift started, lock the doors. And they would remain locked until the shift ended. A supervisor, the only one who had the keys, would unlock the doors for all the people. Well, as soon as the fire broke out, the supervisor with the keys ran for his life and left the doors locked and all those people to suffer, and prevented the escape, many of those people, as I said, being crushed. The amount of money that was saved, it was calculated by locking these doors through theft. The amount of money that was saved was roughly $20. Now, that is in 1911 dollars, to be fair, but let's just say it was $1,000. The amount of lives that were lost was 146. It just wasn't worth that. And such tragedy was the result of someone else locking the doors and preventing an escape. But what if the same person who had locked the doors also held the key and then perished? Wouldn't that be just incredible? And someone would say, well, how ridiculous. All he had to do was use the key and unlock the door and then would be open. And that's the kind of the point I'm trying to get at in a spiritual application, is that Christians are able to escape their present circumstances but are unwilling to lock the door that they themselves often lock, that they themselves often block in some way. Or they refuse to open the door that God himself opened and then beckoned to us and says, come here, come to this door instead. Is that still ridiculous? Well, yes, in a sense it is. But it happens, it appears, all too often. Specifically, I'm speaking of limiting ourselves based upon decisions that we make, imprisoning ourselves by bars that we install, locking ourselves in or out, as it might be, by doors that we lock, not God. What I'm talking about is something that you might be familiar with, even personally, is sabotaging our own opportunities for advancement. Put another way, God provides a way of escape, but many people reject that open door and stand in front of a locked door instead, one that God never led to, one that God says does not lead to salvation, one that will not open, and then, of all things, they turn around and blame God. We are a strange people, aren't we? Lately, I've been talking in our lessons about the need for change and growth, and what this lesson is addressing is those who are standing back and say, well, yeah, I know change and growth would be good if it only could happen to me, but I can't. And the truth is, those people simply won't, because they've chosen not to. They have locked the door. And then they stand in front of a locked door, and they say, well, this just can't happen for me. But it's not the door that God locked, and it's not necessarily even the door that God wants you to stand in front of. This lesson, then, is designed to expose that myth of this I can't mentality, which, in the language of our recent lessons, falls into the old self-thinking. It's not new life thinking or new self-thinking. It's old self-thinking, which is supposed to be put to death and which we are to continually be putting to death in our lives. But here it is, popping up once again, bubbling to the surface. And instead, I want to ask you candidly, just as I ask myself all the time, what prevents you and I from changing? What prevents us from growing? What prevents us from getting rid of the stumbling blocks and producing the fruit of the Spirit instead, as we've just been talking about recently? We dare not accuse God of something for which we ourselves are responsible. And if God is asking us to do something in His Word, whatever it is, then you know that He's given you the power and the ability and the opportunity to do it. When He says do this, that means that it can be done. I want to stress here that what I'm not talking about is struggling, but really resistance. Okay? In other words, struggling and resistance are not the same thing. Everyone struggles. Every Christian struggles. Every person struggles. But resistance is simply stiffening your arm against God and holding that out and saying, I will not. That is rebellion. That is unbelief. Everyone struggles and says, God, I know this is hard, and I know this is really something that I'm not familiar with, but I'll do it because you are right, and I love you, and I want to do your will. That is struggling, but the resistance is something else. So how are you living your life? Are you living by faith, or are you living in these pockets of resistance? Matthew chapter 8, verse 7 through 9 that you see on the screen here, Jesus says, woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks, for it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come, but woe to that man through whom they come. And then he goes on to say something pretty radical here. If your foot causes you to stumble or your hand causes you to stumble, it's better to cut that off rather than to enter into what he calls the eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to stumble, better to pluck it out rather than to enter into the eternal fire with one eye. Or both eyes, rather than to enter into life with just one. Now, he's not talking literal here. Don't go cutting your eye out or your hand off. That's not what he's asking you. But what he is talking about is something that is so dear to you as if it were connected to you that intimately as your hand or your eye. What he's saying, in essence, is no matter what it is that is in your life that is so dear to you but that is wrong, that has to go, it's part of that old life and that old thinking mentality, if it doesn't belong there and God's telling you to get rid of it, then he's saying you need to get rid of it. That's tough, isn't it? That is really hard to do. So God never approves of anyone trying to purposely throw an obstacle or hindrance in someone else's way, but what about if it is in your own path? What if you're the one throwing the stumbling block in front of yourself? You say, well, no one would ever do that. I think people do it all the time. I think people actually are the source of many of their own problems. Much of what we call problems in our life, unfortunately, are self-inflicted. And then we turn around and we blame religion, or we blame the church, or we blame the preacher. Believe that. I mean, come on. Or we blame the elders, or we blame God of all people. That's just not right. But here we are. We do these sort of things. And is God just as disapproving of that as he would be if you threw that in front of someone else's path? Most certainly he is. I've been hearing for the last 30-some-odd years how some person or event or circumstances or the infamous bad experience here prevented a Christian from serving God faithfully and saying something like, well, I would be more faithful, I would be more devoted, I would be stronger, I would be fill in the blank, except that someone prevented me and then offers that alleged reason as to why. Or, in the case of those who are not even Christians, well, here's the reason why I can't become a Christian. It's because, and then fill in the blank with one of the more common ones. Well, the church is all about money. There's a bunch of hypocrites in the church. Well, I think God has been unfair to me. I think he should have done this or that and the other thing, and he didn't, and I hold him accountable. Or one of those other, you know, crutches that people use as to why they can't believe, why they can't believe. And it's really not a cannot issue. Someone says, well, you know, Christians have been unkind and unfair to me in the past. And obviously, that wouldn't have been your decision. You wouldn't have asked for that. However, you do allow that to become your stumbling block if you choose. It wasn't your decision for what happened, but it is your decision to allow what happened to now be what's happening. And that is to allow that to be the reason or the excuse. And someone says, well, I just can't get over that. But the truth is, well, you just won't get over that. You just won't. Don't make it a can't thing because it's a will not thing, not a cannot thing. Or someone says, well, I don't have the same talent as someone else, and that prevents me from, you know, serving in whatever way as they do. Well, yeah, it prevents you from serving in the same capacity, but it doesn't prevent you from serving. It doesn't prevent you from serving at all. In fact, in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9, God says to Paul, my grace is sufficient for you. And Paul says, well, then I'll be satisfied with my weaknesses and my inadequacies and so on. Because it's God's grace that needs to be promoted here, not what I can't do or what I'm limited in doing. And yet what we hear sometimes, even from our own mouth, whether we realize it or not, we hear sometimes, well, here's the reason why I can't serve God more. It's because I'm limited. Well, of course you are. In some way, all of us are. That's what makes us human and not gods. But we have to believe that God is able to work through that weakness of ours. Someone says, well, it's my spouse that's the problem. Or my unfulfilling or my stifling marriage. That's the reason why I can't serve God appropriately or diligently. I can't serve because of her or because of him. When the truth is, I won't serve because of him or her, and I've used that person as my stumbling block. I've taken that person and thrown them in my own path and said, there is the reason why I can't do that. Here is my excuse. And do you really think that God approves of such language or such reasoning? It is true that if others, especially those closest to us, don't cooperate with our desire to serve, that does make our responsibility more difficult to carry out. There's no question. But it doesn't make it impossible. We're told in Matthew 19, verse 26, there that with all things, I should say, all things are possible with God regarding salvation. And that means that nothing is impossible with God. He can work through whatever it is that you are facing. It is also true that if others don't help us or cooperate with us, but distract or interfere or whatever they do, you may not be able to serve as you want to serve or serve as you used to serve or feel comfortable serving, but you will be able to serve because God will provide a way. He will provide a way of escape from your limitation, not just from your temptations, but also from your limitation. And I don't have to be the one to get up here and tell you how that's going to happen for you. I don't have to be the one that's going to outline where that's going to take you and where that's going to go and how you're supposed to serve personally. I'm telling you that what God says about the matter, and that you need to believe in that just as much as I do. We need to be believers and not resistors. Interesting thing, many Christians have kids and then use those same children as a reason why they can't serve more. I find this rather remarkable, because who decided for them to have children in the first place? Well, usually they did. It's not always the case, as we know, but when they make the decision to have children, and then you have to ask the question, well, should everyone be faithful to the Lord only if they don't have children? In other words, when I hear sometimes, not in recent memory, I'm not pointing fingers at any people, but I'm just saying that one thing I have heard over time is the children excuse. Well, you know, the reason why we can't come, we can't participate, we can't be more involved, we can't do more for the Lord, we can't serve in just about any way until these children are grown and out of the house, then we'll be active, you know, and it's because of our kids. And that's just not true. You're using your children as pawns there. You're using them as an excuse. God blessed you with children. He didn't limit you or cripple you with children. Look at them as a blessing, but not as a stumbling block. Well, a person actually uses his own children as a stumbling block? Yeah, he can. In fact, this can work both ways, and I've heard this happen before, where a couple can't have children, and then they get mad over that or upset or emotionally traumatized by the fact they can't have children, so they just become immobilized. They can't do anything. Because, you know, God hasn't granted their request. I want you to think about what we're talking about, where we're using other people, sometimes our spouses, sometimes our children, just sometimes other random people, and using them as stumbling blocks for ourselves. That's just not right. Sometimes we choose to spend time with family and relatives and friends at the expense of our commitment to the congregation, which, by the way, you made, not me. I didn't make your commitment to this congregation, and you didn't make mine. I'm not talking about vacations and special occasions like that. I'm talking about allowing others to take you away from what you know you are committing to here. I'm talking about giving those people first priority and always at our expense. That's what I'm talking about. You made a commitment to this group. Keep that commitment. That commitment needs to be honored. And not forgotten and not trampled on every opportunity that someone calls you up and says, hey, let's go here or let's do this or let's, come to our whatever we're doing. And it happens to be on a Sunday right when you're worshiping God. And you say, okay, What have you just done there? We're filling our time with activities and missions and hobbies and projects, even noble ones, then claiming, well, I'm just too busy to serve. Well, who decided you're too busy? Didn't you do that? Didn't you make yourself too busy to serve? And now you're using that as a reason why you can't serve? If you can decide something like that, can't you undecide it? And if you choose something like that, can't you unchoose it? With the same power that you had to decide it or choose it in the first place, can't you undo that? Of course you can, if you wanted to. But your walk with Jesus has to be worth that decision. And you can't ignore your responsibility to God and to the church because the plate is too full that you filled. Some would say, and this is going to be always an issue in any congregation, well, you know, I'm growing old and my health is deteriorating, and well, that's not my choice. Well, agreed, at least on the first part, that you're growing old. Nobody can stop that. Whether you realize it or not, nobody wants to admit it, but we're all growing old in this group right now, okay? And it's not limited to this group. It's just part of life. We're all growing older. Whether your health is declining is not always something that's imposed upon you. Sometimes we choose very poor lifestyles and very poor health habits, and then our health deteriorates, and then we say, well, see what the situation I'm in. All right, well, that's another story, and I'm not even going to go down that road right now. Regardless, is it possible that someone can use either their age or their declining health as a reason why they can't serve God? Of course, it's possible, but is it right? Declining age or declining ability may change what you do, but it can't change who you are. You're a disciple of Christ. If indeed you're a Christian, you're a disciple, and that can't be affected by your age or your physical abilities. I have seen and continue to see Christians in walkers, in wheelchairs, with oxygen tanks, with missing limbs, in chronic pain, having to endure cancer, having to endure diabetes, various diseases, even those who are bedridden, who are servants of God and continue to serve their Lord in whatever way they could under the circumstances. They didn't give up. I admire those people, and they set a noble example for the rest of us. I've seen other Christians who proportionally get a little sliver in their finger, and they're laid up for a week or so, and they just can't do anything until that huge misery gets resolved. And that's not an example for us. Matthew chapter 19, verse 16 and following, we have the story or the account there of the rich young ruler coming to Jesus and saying, in essence, what do I lack? And in verse 21, Jesus answers in essence, here is what prevents you, your accumulation of land and wealth, but it is within your power to remove that with God's help. He will do this for you. He will help you with this. Come, follow me. It was within his power to do that. Jesus wasn't saying, well, what you need to do is you need to make $1 billion and then you need to go out and distribute that $1 billion to all the poor in all the world as if you could do something like that in the first place. No, he's actually saying quite the opposite. It is within your power to take what you have and use it for something different than what you're using it for now. You have full control. But as you know, just because you point out some stumbling block in a person's life doesn't mean they're going to remove it, right? I think we've all probably been the victim of that. We know what we're talking about because we've experienced that. We've been that person where someone pointed out to us, hey, that's not right. We said, oh, yeah, okay, I know it's not right, but I'm going to do it anyway, or something like that. We just sit there and resisted. We gave the stiff arm to that person. The reasons may vary as to why, but ultimately what it comes down to when we're stiff-arming God, that is, it's unbelief. Call it what you want to. Justify it if you have to, or if that makes sense to you. Rationalize it however you want to, but the bottom line is you don't believe what God told you to do. You say, well, how do you know that? Because you would have done it if you did. That's the reason. You would have just done it if you did really, truly believe. You have a lack of trust when you and I do those things. We manifest a lack of trust in what God says or why he says it. Now imagine a Christian then who prays to God, Lord, why can't I be more spiritual? Why can't I draw near to you? Because that's been really the subject of a lot of our lessons of late, drawing near to God. Someone says, well, I'm struggling with that. Okay, that's not a problem. Struggling in itself. Remember, we all struggle. But what if he's resisting that situation, that drawing near? And then he prays to God and says, Lord, I just don't understand. I mean, you know, I go to church, I read my Bible, I say prayers, I take the Lord's Supper, I sing the songs. I don't get why I'm not drawing near to you. And then God reveals to that person in one way or the other, here is your problem, and it's within your power to overcome it, and I will help you. Now what? Now it's decision time. That person has been brought to confront his problem. And now that he has confronted his problem, what is he going to do with it? You might be that person I'm talking about right now. You might be the person that God has revealed the problem to, and now you're wondering what you're going to do about that. You prayed, God, please reveal to me what my problem is, just like with a rich young man. What prevents me, or what must I do to obtain eternal life? And God says, well, this is actually what needs to be done. And now you're going, oh, that. Or you're going, well, I'm not going to get rid of that. What else is my problem? Or something along that line. You know how we are, how we kind of weasel around things sometimes when it's, expedient to do so, as we say. Now, here's the opposite example. Consider the Ethiopian there in Acts chapter 8, verse 29 and following. Here's a man who's reading Isaiah. Philip comes up to him and says, what are you reading? And the guy says, I don't know. I'm reading Isaiah, but who's he talking about? And Philip says, let me help you. And he preaches Jesus to him. And then in chapter 8, verse 36, the Ethiopian says, what prevents me from being baptized? I strongly desire to obey the Lord. What could possibly stop me? Well, it's not a matter of him being qualified, because God was calling this man through his word. That qualifies him. Now, since he has heard, he has believed, he's willing to commit, he says, what prevents me? And Philip says, in essence, nothing. Nothing prevents you. Let's do this thing. That's an excellent question to ask ourselves. What prevents us? Will we ask it of ourselves? What prevents me? What prevents you? What prevents me from letting go of my past in order to press forward to the upward call of God in Christ Jesus? What prevents me or you from letting go of our baggage and our old grudges and our old hurts and the past and whatever someone did to us that was mean and uncalled for and unconscionable and all those words that you could use that it's true, all that happened, but nonetheless, it did happen, and here you are. What prevents you from letting go? It may require forgiveness on your part. It may require some major reorganizing of your life. It may require you to abandon certain habits or certain lifestyles and so on, but do you believe in God sufficiently? Do you believe him to the point where he says, if you do this thing, then you will draw near to me? Do you believe him that much? What prevents you from doing that? What prevents you from not only making a change of mind, like I will commit to God, but also a change of the heart? Not just saying it with your mouth, but also believing it with your heart. And also, commensurate with that going along with that, they're putting to death those deeds of the flesh that corrupt your life and are standing in your way. What prevents you from doing that? And those people that are standing in your way, getting rid of those relationships, of those people that are causing you to stumble. What prevents you from doing everything in your power, just as we talked about last week, to produce that fruit of the Spirit? What prevents you from actually surrendering your heart to Christ without conditions, without procrastinations, and without any strings attached? Not, Lord, I'll give my heart to you if or when or because, but rather simply, I'll give my heart to you, period. What prevents you and I from doing that? What prevents us from sharing the gospel with someone, talking to them about the Lord? Well, of course, it can be done. We know that. But what's the likelihood of it being done? Remember, Kevin gave an illustration one time as an invitation about possibilities versus probabilities. Of course, it's possible for you to talk to someone, but what's the probability of it? What's the likelihood of it? I know it's possible for you to share the gospel. When is it actually going to happen, if indeed it hasn't been happening? If indeed you're the one that's making it not happen? You need to confront those reasons why you think, anyway, that it cannot be done in the first place, like fear and loss, and it's uncomfortable, and the time it takes and the energy. I get those. I understand those. I've confronted all those myself. I have to constantly confront those, just as you would. Now I'm asking you, though, that do these things really prevent you from doing those, doing that thing there, or have you simply chosen to close that door? Think about what I'm saying. God has opened up a door for you to talk to someone and you slammed it shut. Or you walked away from that open door and you went to a closed one instead and said, well, this person's not listening to me. Well, of course they're not, because the open door is right over here. This person is not only waiting to hear you, but God led you to that person and opened the door and said, there they are. See, the thing about open doors and God and Him opening them is that sometimes we pray fervently, God, open doors, please open doors, please open doors. And then He opens the door and then we go, I didn't mean that door. Or we think that it's so scary what's on the other side of that door, now that it's open, we kind of start backpedaling. We go, well, you know, I really wasn't as insistent as I thought. Maybe there can be another way, okay, or something along that line. I only know these things because I've done them myself, all right? So I understand the rationale, the justification. What prevents you and I from serving as genuine disciples of the Master? Not with a divided heart, but fully dedicated to Christ. Along that line, what prevents us from seeking first His kingdom and His righteousness, as Matthew 6:33 tells us to do, as Jesus Himself in that passage instructs us to do? What prevents us from, what causes us, from allowing people and things and bad habits to compromise our commitments and to compromise our situation there? Along that lines, this is going to sound personal. And remember, I wrote this lesson earlier in the week, not this morning, okay? This will make sense in a minute. What prevents us from assembling with this congregation in its regular assembly times? Especially if you're a member here, because that's part of the commitment you made to this congregation when you came on board. When we meet, you'll be here. You'll participate. You'll support us. Should we just keep this group alive and well-oiled and everything running here so that when you decide to come, that we're here? Or should you be a part of us coming together? Let's think about things like that. Are there real obstacles there, or is this a self-inflicted situation, a self-chosen? We could say the same thing about being on time. Are there real hindrances, or those imposed stumbling blocks? I'm not talking about, you know, you had a flat tire, the kid threw up or something. Those things happen. I'm talking about chronic patterns where it's always like this, where it's always the same way, and you're the one that's always coming in late. And the disruption that creates and all the things that prevents there, who's determining that? Who's making that decision there? We claim as a group that we want to grow. I hear that all the time among different members. Well, we want to grow. We want to get bigger. We want to get stronger. We want to do this and that. Let me ask you, what are you willing personally to do to help us to grow? Are you willing to make the commitment that is absolutely necessary for us to grow? Because if you're just one of the, you know, people in the crowd that's saying, yeah, we need to grow, you know, and then we come up to you and say, okay, what are you going to do? Nothing. But I'm all for it, you know. I mean, what good is that? We don't need cheerleaders here. What we actually need is participants. We actually need people who are going to get on the field and get their hands dirty, if you know what I'm talking about, right? Not people sitting in the bleachers there, kind of going rah, rah, or people with pom-poms. We actually need people who can actually do the work. Whatever work needs to get done. And sometimes what people say is, well, we want to grow. And what they mean by that is, like people to me or you know, someone else that's, you know, that's doing certain things are saying, well, and I expect you to do it. Why aren't you doing it? And sometimes that's fair, because maybe I'm not doing everything I need to do. Maybe I need to do more. And maybe I need to revisit what I'm doing. Maybe it's not very effective. Maybe it's not very efficient. All right, I'll give you that. But I'm also asking you, what are you doing? And is that effective? And is that efficient? Are you willing to endure the difficulties and challenges of growth? Because it's one thing to ask for growth, but when we get new people here and they bring all their luggage and their baggage and their issues and their past teachings and their misinformation and we have to deal with that, okay? You have to deal with that. Are you willing to deal with that, or are you just going to let someone else deal with that? The spring meeting's coming up. We have a pretty good subject that is purposely designed to capture the interest of many people, peering into the afterlife. Are you planning on attending? I'm speaking to our congregation now. Are you planning on attending? Or do you already have your reasons why you won't be here? Are you inviting people to come? Or are you inviting people to come when you know that you won't be here? How does that work exactly? Are you praying for its success? If you're truly unable to be here, are you at least praying fervently for its success? And are you going to be a part of that success? What prevents you and I from loving God with all our heart and our soul and our strength and our mind? You know, Jesus offers that not as a suggestion, like, hey, wouldn't it be nice if you could love God that deeply? But if you don't, it's okay. Enter in, good and faithful servant. Or isn't he saying that as an absolute requirement, that this is the level of servitude I am looking for, that I desperately need for you? I need you to love me with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind. And you say, well, I'm not there. Okay, but are you striving to get there? Are you working on it? I can understand struggling, but are you resisting or struggling? Do you really mean that when you say that you love the Lord? Or are you allowing self-made, self-inflicted stumbling blocks to clutter your path and then say, well, I'm just not able, when the fact is you're just not willing? If you are a Christian, you committed not merely to believing in the Lord, but serving Him as the Lord. In other words, not just saying, well, I believe that God is God and Jesus is Lord. What you actually committed to was not just identifying, but serving Him as Lord. And that commitment hasn't gone away. And as time goes on, that commitment ought not to fade and diminish. That ought to grow stronger and more fervent. And you should be focusing on that all the more, not all the less. And I've been saying for the last several years that society is not getting friendlier toward Christians. And this world is not making it easier for you to be a Christian. And so you're going to have to get stronger, not weaker. You're going to have to get more dedicated, not less. You're going to have to simply choose where you stand, not sit there and waffle and try to straddle and try to, you know, hold both sides. And, you know, when times get tough, then you default to the old life thinking. If upon examination you see your path to glory is cluttered with stumbling blocks and excuses, you have to seriously do some soul searching there and ask yourself, am I willing to lose my eternity with God just to keep those things? Now back to our little fire scenario that we started with. The company wanted to save, you know, $20, but in doing so they lost 146 lives. They wanted to save a little tiny bit, but they ended up losing so much. And I think that's exactly what people are doing today. When Jesus says, you know, if you gain the whole world, that is very small in comparison to what you lose, your soul. And what's really happening is people aren't gaining the whole world. They're just gaining a little bit of time, a little bit of privilege, a little bit of advancement as they see it, a little bit of something, a little bit of material wealth or a little bit of fun, whatever it might be, and they're losing something in the process that is so valuable. And you say of something like the fire scenario, well, you know, $20 versus 146 lives. I mean, how could they in good conscience allow something like that to happen? Well, how could we in good conscience give up our souls for this little tiny speck of something we call pleasure or opportunity or material advancement or some kind of gain or whatever it might be? How could we do that? Are you locking the doors of opportunity that God has opened and then claiming, well, I just can't do this? Are you blocking the way of escape that God provides to resist temptation and then saying, well, I just can't resist it? Are you throwing stumbling blocks into your path and then, of all things, blaming God because you got stumbling blocks there? I know how we reason, because I'm one of you. And I know what I have done in the past and how it doesn't work. And I've tried to rationalize, I've tried to justify, I've tried to do all the things you probably have tried to do, maybe that you're doing right now. And I'm here to tell you, not only does it not work, but it violates everything that we claim to believe as Christians. Galatians 5, verse 7, Paul says to them, "You were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion did not come from God. It comes from something else. We were once running well, perhaps, but now we're dragging our feet. Where'd that come from? Well, it didn't come from God. It's not God asking you to drag your feet. Such persuasion to stop running, start procrastinating, to stop serving the Lord and start serving something or someone else, that doesn't come from God. He doesn't approve of it, and he doesn't convince us to do those things. So don't convince yourself otherwise if indeed you're doing that. If God has called you with his gospel, nothing in the world can prevent you from following him if you choose to believe him and obey him. You could throw out whatever excuse you want to, but the bottom line is just sheer unbelief. You just don't believe yet. Hopefully you will. Hopefully you'll have time to do so. In Romans chapter 8, verse 35 and following, the passage that Cliff read for us, Paul asked rhetorical questions. What prevents God from justifying us? Implied, nothing. What prevents Christ from helping us? Nothing. Who or what can stop us from loving or serving our master? Nothing. Who could stop our master from loving us? Absolutely nothing. There's really only one answer that can stop you from loving Christ. It's not anything in this world. It's not people. There's only one thing that could stop you, and that would be you. If the premise were that you were not in the way, there would be nothing to stop you at all. There would be nothing else that could stop you from doing that, from loving him and serving him. If you don't have a right relationship with the Lord today, what prevents you from having that? If you're not a Christian this morning, what prevents you from being a Christian? And of course, I'm assuming that you've done your homework. You know what I'm talking about. You're not just going off a spur-of-the-moment emotional ambition here, but that you've actually read, because no one in the Scripture becomes a Christian until he learns what that means and then counts the cost of that. But nonetheless, say you've done that. Say you're sitting here this morning and you've done all that and you're still sitting here. What prevents you from doing what needs to be done? There's only one answer, and that is you. And let me remind you, as we will talk about in our series coming up, that the day of the Lord is coming. And God is bringing fire and judgment. We don't like to talk about stuff like that. It just sounds so, you know, politically incorrect. But nonetheless, it is going to happen regardless. And he's bringing that fire and judgment against two groups of people, those who don't know the Lord because they chose not to, and those who don't obey the Lord because they chose not to. He's not talking about people who couldn't know or people who were unable to know. There might be situations like that. Let God decide. He's talking about people who chose not to know and chose not to obey. And you can avoid such a terrible end, but only if you don't reject the way of escape that God is providing you. On the other hand, and let's leave on a positive note here, if you give your very best for the master, which you just sang before this lesson, if you give your best for the master, despite the circumstances, despite the limitations, despite the weaknesses that you might have, then he will give you every grace to succeed and to flourish in your walk with him. Can you believe this? Of course you can. The question is, will you and do you believe this? I know it's a strong lesson. It's strong to give, it's strong to hear. I understand that, and I don't like being in this position. But at the same time, we can't go forward if we're just throwing out excuses and our so-called reasons and our justifications why we can't. You know, everyone else should do this, but I can't because, or, you know, I expect you to do that, but I can't because, and then giving ourselves all this license to be procrastinating, irresponsible, lazy, whatever it might be, people, or just simply being clouded in our vision here. Our vision to heaven is so clouded sometimes. So I'm trying to cut to the core of what's going on here, and I hope that you take it in that way, okay? And in case you think you're on the hot seat this morning, I put myself there first. And I want you, I'm not just telling you that, I want you to hold me accountable to what I say. And if you find that I'm slipping up in some way, well, you'd be my friend to point that out. Do it nicely, okay? But you would be my friend to point that out. So we're here to help one another. We're not here to accuse and point fingers. We're here to help one another. But at the same time, we got to be honest with each other too, don't we? We've got to be honest with ourselves. We've got to be honest with God. That's what this is all about. If you're subject to our invitation, if you're ready to be honest with the Lord, honest with yourself, honest to what you claim to believe, this will be your time in the service to respond. Come forward if you need to as we stand and sing the song, Richard Selected.